Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D Live, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett, and tonight for the first time we're coming to you with a studio audience from Monocle's HQ in Marylebone, that's Midori House. I'm joined by three of London's brightest design minds. Eric Speakerman is one of the world's best-known typographers and designers and has strong thoughts on the future of the city, the media and much, much more. Joanna Agerman-Ross is curator of 20th century and contemporary furniture and product design at the Victoria and Albert Museum. She's also the founder and former editor-in-chief of the envelope-pushing design publication Disegno. And last, but by no means least, Peter Murray is the chairman of both New London Architecture and the London Society, not to mention one of the most insightful design and architecture critics around today. Keep listening for their insight over the next 30 minutes, right here on Monocle 24. So to our live studio audience, that is the smoke and mirrors that goes into making a live radio show. Very little of it is actually live, but I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on stage here now by Eric Speakerman, Joanna Agerman-Ross and Peter Murray. And I'd like to start off by getting right to the heart of the matter. I wrongly introduced you, Eric, as a London designer. You're a man that's based in Berlin. But what I'd actually like to know from you is whether you think London's in a good state, having just voted, well, maybe not London, maybe the UK, to leave the EU, whether this is a positive design environment in your mind for young designers, young architects, young people interested in fashion to come to.
You promised you wouldn't mention Brexit. It's almost like don't mention the war, you know. I mean, it's so embarrassing. It's almost like, you know, hopefully Truxit will happen soon. Trump gets out, but we're all embarrassed by it. London is such a European city in the best possible. I mean, I see more people here from around the world than I think, except New York, anywhere else. And that's what always made London so attractive. I lived here for 10 years and I have a son and a house here. My son is English. So I consider myself sort of kind of like a London designer in the sense that I've suffered here enough, but I also have the advantage of, well, having got to work every morning. I used to live in Holland Park and go to Waterloo, which is mostly cycling back in the 70s, because it's the only way to get there. And it's only got worse. And even at the time, you know, I remember there was a scenario in the Guardian once where they said, you know, there's rain and an accident on Chelsea Bridge and London would collapse. And that was 30 years ago, and it happens every day pretty much. So I love London. It's got fantastic chances to be one of the cultural centers of the world, and it's certainly one of the few things that the Brits still export is design. Let's face it. I mean, we make the cars and the Japanese and the fridges and stuff, and you make design. But the way the city is going should be a bad example, for example, for Berlin, because, you know, setting it all out to luxury apartments that then are left empty, driving up the price, is exactly what's happening in Berlin, and it's the death of any city. And I can't believe that we're not learning from London. London hasn't learned from common sense that every nation, every country, every city has to go through the same bloody mistakes. I don't get it. It's obvious. Obvious, for example, that the car is the worst enemy of a city. We've all known this for decades. Peter, we all know this, and it's still going on. You're still building more fucking, excuse me, we're on live. I mean, this is not my first language, so what does this word mean? This F U. It's French company in the UK,
it's got,
right?
It's got a German lilt to it.
Yeah, sorry. No, I mean, it's all well known, and we still all fall into the same trap. I mean, the traffic here totally sucks, and it's going to kill London. So foreign investment in the sense of buying up luxury apartments for no purpose other than laundering money, not learning that the pedestrian and the cyclist are not enemies of traffic, but the friend of it. In fact, we're all born pedestrian, as far as I certainly was born without wheels. So I'm amazed that London, of all places, isn't at the avant-garde of the world, having learned all this.
So maybe in an attempt to salvage something positive from that, I think we all broadly knew that that was going to be a contentious topic. Joanna, your story about living in London is clearly a personal one. You moved here in the late 90s, the height of cool Britannia, and you hated it. But over time, you learned to love it. You built a career here. You came from Sweden. And your previous job as the editor and founder of Disegno magazine has given way to a new role at the V&A. And I'm wondering what you can do to put a better face forward for London's design scene as an institution. I'm thinking about the reopening of the Design Museum. I'm thinking of the Herzog & de Meuron extension to the Tate. You know, as being positive examples of where London can lead the world. What can you do and what will you do as part of the V&A?
Well, I think in the last few years, the V&A have really been pushing the envelope in terms of what they show in terms of design. The Rapid Response Collection, for example, that now has a permanent space on the first floor of the museum, is very quick at reacting to what's going on in the world. And we acquire objects there that have something to say about the political or social state of things. So, for example, for the Brexit campaign, to mention it again, we acquired a leaflet for the Leave side. And that's something that people now can go and look at and understand the implications of with the kind of reality that we now live in. I think that the museum, the V&A's kind of mission from the beginning has been to appeal to a general public. You know, when it was founded in the mid-19th century, it was one of the first museums that had refreshment room, for example, that people could come and enjoy. And also they had gas lighting, which meant that it could be open after working hours, which meant that people could go and visit it after work. So the V&A has always been about enriching people's lives and making them engage with the designed world from wherever they come from. And we welcome all walks of life and all nationalities, of course.
But a big task to keep you happy.
It's run by a German.
It was run by a German.
Yeah,
unfortunately. He's quit in the last
Brexit.
He did
his own Brexit, unfortunately. Yeah.
Martin,
and he was right.
Resigned the day I started, yeah.
Peter, I'd like to bring you in at this point. I mean, your speciality has been talking about the state of London, its architecture, the foibles, the faux pas, the good things. How is London as a built environment, as a city, providing good examples to cities around the world? And do we all need to have bike lanes like Copenhagen, or dare I say it, a garden bridge? What's London doing well?
Well, I think that London is very different to the rest of England, and I know Eric didn't want to mention Brexit, but I think we remain a European city. I believe very much in Sadiq Khan's campaign about London is open, and I think we'll remain open because we have such a wide and deep culture here. That's not going to go away. And I think rather like New York being very different to the rest of the US, we will stay different. I think the problem with the sort of things that Eric's saying, leaving towers empty and so on, an investment centre, maybe that will improve with Brexit. Perhaps people won't come and invest here quite so much, and some of those homes will reduce in price so they can be owned by Londoners. But I would also reiterate the leader of Barking Council, who now says, don't move to Berlin, move to Barking.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm going to put that out there. I'll let the audience decide on that one. But Eric, if we move on to design and away from the sticky wicket of politics, I think we got off rather lightly there. I don't know about you, but you learnt your trade in a different era. I hope that doesn't make me sound ageist.
I am ancient, yes.
you started out
I can still walk. Unaided.
You've done a wonderful job, without wheels, no less.
Absolutely.
You started out in a type foundry. You started out working with a very physical manner of design. But that's something that we've seen people coming back to. I mean, despite the fact that we spend all day at backlit screens and all of the opportunity that that gives graphic designers, architects, and product designers too, why are people so obsessed with the physical experience of making things, and how do you account for that?
Well, aren't we all physical? I mean, nobody's here made of bits. We're all made of atoms, right? So we're obviously physical, and we cut bread and we eat things. We not live by pills yet, and we've realized that certain things we've given up. You know, we've given up the joy. No, we haven't given up, but some people would like to give up the joy of leafing through the newspaper and, you know, happen what you and I call serendipity. You find something you weren't looking for on the screen, on the internet. You always have to look for stuff. You don't find stuff. Well, you do, but then, you know, your night is ruined because you spent 12 hours. And you can never find what you're looking for. You sometimes find something you weren't looking for, and more often than not, it's crap. So I open a large newspaper every now and again, and I find something I certainly wasn't looking for, and it's totally fascinatingly interesting. People who come to my letterpress workshop come there because it has its own pace. There's, you know, you can't just hit a key and go forward. You have to put stuff in the machine. You have to clean up afterwards. It makes it slow. It is like cooking your own meals, essentially, as opposed to going and buying, going to Wagamama or whatever and bringing a carton back of stuff and eating it possibly while you're on the phone and walking or on your bicycle or on the tube or whatever. So I think it's just normal that we suddenly remember, my God, you know, we are actually normal physical beings. We have eyes and two hands, and there's a certain distance here, and that's why books are a certain size. I mean, God didn't make books. You know, Gutenberg did, and the And the Italians found the small size. The Gutenberg Bible had to have wheels on. But, you know, the normal books, so we're coming back. I mean, look at the size of Monocle. You know, it's that size because it's the optimal size to hold. Well, it's a little too big maybe for optimal, but it's... Well, because it depends where you read it. I mean, if you read on a table, it's fine. But if you read it sitting up in bed or whatever, there is a reason why all these things exist. And we suddenly remember, my God, as long as we eat normal food and we put socks and we actually move in a physical environment, we also need physical activities.
Our creative director was giddy as a schoolgirl when you complimented the typography of Monocle. Now you've rejected its size.
No, not at all. I'm just saying there are optimal size for different purposes. And a magazine has to make a compromise. Because you don't know, are people going to read it on the train, sitting down at lunchtime, lying back in there, but you don't know, so you have to allow a certain area around the optimal. But, you know, I'm saying a novel has a certain optimal size because it's a certain, we have a radius in our eyes and there's a certain distance we can see a lowercase letter. It's that's physical. That's nothing I can do about it.
And Joanna, before you became part of the V&A, part of the eminent institution that it is, you founded a rather wonderful magazine back in 2011. I still remember when the first copy landed on my desk with a thump. You chose print as a medium, and just to continue this theme of the physicality and the tangible products that the design world yields, why did you start a physical magazine rather than a noisy blog?
For me, that was the only way that we could really put across the projects that we were wanting to publish in a nice environment. I think that online is good for certain things, news for example, but if you want to talk about a designer's work over a period of time, sometimes, you know, several years, decades, it seems like online doesn't really provide the right environment to write and project that. So for me, it was really important that we used beautiful paper, working with a great printer, you know, investing in making something tactile and lovely to hold and interact with.
If we delve under the covers, what kind of stories did you see a dearth of in the market? What were you trying to identify to talk about?
Well, for us, Disegno has always been about process. We've always been interested in looking at the process of design. We have consciously not been mainstream because there's no point trying to be a mainstream title in 2011 or 2016. And as a result, we really focused on being as specialized as we could, you know, investing in long-form writing, photo reportages and so on, and making the most we can of the medium that we decided to exist in. I should add that we also have a website and we do engage with people on that level as well, but that does something very different to what the printed magazine does.
And so before we plummet headlong into our immodest aim to dissect what good design is, I'll just ask you, Peter Murray, with your editor's hat on. You obviously founded Blueprint magazine in 1983. You know, are we all commentators today? I mean, the prevalence of magazines is all well and good. They tend to be smaller, more niche publications, as Joanna said. You know, are we talking about design in the correct way? And do magazines hold any truck anymore? Or should we be going along to bloggers who are taking pictures of stuff at shows and on the ground?
I think they do, and I'd say that because of the points Eric was making, the physicality of magazines, and I think you need to design magazines and you print them and you make them smell like they are things that you would treasure and enjoy. But interesting enough, we actually started Blueprint magazine because there was nobody really talking about wider issues about design at the time to be a general magazine for a wider public. We didn't really succeed very well in doing that. We got out to a lot of people who were commentators in other fields, and so we had an influence. But you know, a chap called Tyler Brulé came into the office a few times, and we were chatting about this, and then a few years later out popped a magazine, which is actually, I think, very much what we thought we were going to produce at Blueprint. We didn't quite have the skills to do it.
Are you saying that Tyler Brulé stole Monocle from you? Just as a question.
No. I think that Wallpaper was actually had a lot of the ingredients which we thought we would get, but we weren't very good at getting out of the design field. All our advertisers came from furniture manufacturers. Tyler had the genius of getting out into a much wider world, wider support, and it succeeded. And then, of course, Monocle followed.
And let's not forget that I think one really important aspect of producing a magazine is that it's very expensive. So, you know, you do need to have the proper investment to make the most of it and to reach the audience you want to reach. And I think that's the thing that you find a lot of younger, smaller publishers struggling with.
And so one of the tenets of this evening was to talk about what good design is. And Eric, is Good Design a clean typeface? Is it a car from the late 60s? I know about your cherished car. I've been reading all day. You know, what is a good design object? And, you know, how would you quantify it?
Well, I guess there's two purposes. The one, of course, is function. Whatever function is, you know, a spoon that doesn't shuffle soup into your mouth, is it not a good spoon? Obviously. But there's also the pleasure to behold, the aesthetic added value, the aesthetische Mehrwert, as the Germans say so nicely. There is something to it. You know, anything could be designed just to function. Obviously, then we wouldn't have a lot of stuff in this room, obviously. You know, we'd all be wearing the same pair of shoes, probably. The same type of shoes, sorry, I should say. So that added value is essentially what distinguishes us from, you know, the next chimpanzee who has already worked out some tools to get ants from a hole. We're a little further than that. But we are the first animal that has actually an idea of its own identity. That's the main difference between us and animals, that we know who we are, or at least we know we should be somebody, or we ask, where am I going, is there life before death, kind of thing, which is what it's all about. So that also means we know what we're doing, and we know that it's more pleasure to hold something, to use something more beautiful than less beautiful. And whatever is beautiful is in, you know, there are fashions, and you might not like this fashion, you might not like the last fashion, but we have opinions about this, and there's always a constant stream of new products, and whether there's new typefaces or new paintings or new chairs. I mean, who needs another chair? Who needs another book? You know, people always write, you know, ask me, how come you have so many bicycles? And I say, you know, the optimal number of bicycles, books, chairs is N plus one. You always need one more because there's a cool thing coming out. You want to have it because it's pleasure. So good design for me, in other words, is that fulfills both the physical and the emotional need.
And Peter,
Even intellectual on top of that, maybe.
There is a bit of a discourse in design about taking away things that are superfluous, these things that can, you know, achieve their mission without any unnecessary adornments on them. But can't something that's broken be a piece of good design, even if that time's passed? What do you think?
I wouldn't say broken, but I think adaptable. I think that for a lot of products, and certainly buildings, adaptability is a key factor in not just today's market. You know, if you look at the Georgian house, that is something that has been adapted over the years from single family homes to flats to offices and back again to single family homes. You look at Victorian warehouses turned into apartments. Now we're building blocks of flats, which actually you can't do anything to you can't do anything to if you want to change single bed into double bed, knock a wall out. You can't do any of that. And I think that's very short-sighted because and that is partly to do with design. That's because an architect or a designer is given a job to design something to very controlled parameters of cost and size and so on. He does that as a good piece of design, i.e. he fulfills his brief, but it isn't necessarily what is right for wider society and longer term needs beyond his individual client. And I think that that's one of the things that designers don't do enough of, is actually think beyond their immediate response to an instruction from a client. And I know it's not always easy to do that, but all designers have a responsibility to a client, but they also have a responsibility to the wider environment and the public as a whole.
So designers, not developers, should be building our cities?
Well, I think that designers should not necessarily take the lead. I think they do have to accommodate all sorts of things, and public consultation is a key part of now how we deliver change to our city, because we have given people freedom through communications, through democracy generally, to want to have a say in how they shape their environments. And if you deny them that, then that is in itself a bad piece of design. The good designer can bring together all these many strands. And that's actually what designers do. They bring together a whole series of strands and they create a coherent element out of that.
Yeah. And Joanna, you have the unenviable task at the V&A of maybe categorising what's considered the good design of the past. I mean, is it an Eames chair? Is it an, you know, underappreciated piece of furniture from Norway in the 70s? How do you go about categorising what good design is without it just being a value judgment or something that we've poured positive feelings on over the past 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think the discussion around good design isn't really part of contemporary design discourse, because I think that it's often connected to aesthetic and form. And I think a lot of contemporary design is not necessarily about that. It's more about reacting much more to the needs of society, the needs of people. At the V&A, I think that we have a fantastic 20th century collection of people that have tried to solve the conundrum of what is good design and how can this design impact or even change the world. And for me, it's an extremely satisfying job learning to know those objects and learning to know what the makers and designers behind those objects were thinking at the time when they were being produced. And it's also my job to put that across to general audience to understand it better. However, I don't think that we nowadays look at it as such. You know, we see it as something that's a little bit part of history, that is part of telling the history of the 20th century, both in social and political terms, but it's not necessarily saying this is good or was good design. We like to talk about objects from another point of view. What does it say about the society in which it was made? What does it say about the people that used it? What does it say about the politics in that particular part of the world? And those are things that are endless stories that you can find while looking through the archives at the V&A.
And in Monocle, we're big fans of the idea of making subtle interventions on behalf of good design, whether that means if you start a shop, putting a bench outside so people can linger, to add to the street life, the little things that you can do to create a positive environment in which to live and great products in which to consume. And Eric, you're staging your own intervention. You're actually putting on a space in Berlin in which you intend to give people something that you think the city lacks, that's space to make noise, space to print, space to make things. Yeah, how important is it, do you think, to do that? And why don't you share the priorities of a, say, developer?
Well, some of you might know that a property developer needs 25-30% return on their capital. This is a shitload of profit, to put it bluntly. If I did something like this, I would borrow money from a bank. I need a 4-5% return because that's what the banks charge me. And if you cut that down, you can build cheap buildings. It's simply cutting out the various middlemen and 25% every time this moves up the ladder. So that's why building has become so terribly expensive. Now, there is a need, certainly in Berlin and probably also here, for space that normal people can use. Like in our case, we suddenly have a resurgence of bakeries. We have people in the city who actually bake bread. They don't make it in some factory and bring it and heat it up. They actually make it, like the old days. I remember bakers on every block. And I remember a tailor on every block and a carpenter on every block. Now, all these people do exist. They tend to be startups. Now, the baker we have there is a startup. Whatever, he still makes bread. And the carpenter is a startup and the bookbinder is a startup, but they still bind books and make tables and chairs. But they've all been forced to move out of the city. So they spend an hour every day traveling there, going back, don't see their kids before they go, all this crap that we've seen happening here. Why don't these people stay in the city? And so if we can find a building where we gather some of those, I hate to use the word craft because it sort of like has those sort of, you know, your own sort of
censorship
knitted thingy, yeah. But, you know, there are people who make shit, let's put it that way. There should have been stuff. I was running out of Fs here. I used too many F words, I suppose. So why not bring these people together? You know, we have lots of these shared workspaces, but they all tend to be for people who look at screens all day long, and I think we have enough of those. So I'm trying to find a space in Berlin, or a couple of spaces if possible, where we bring those people together, actually make stuff that we need on a daily basis, because we need to eat bread on a daily basis. People actually starting, your vegans or look or listen away now, even butchers are coming back into the cities. I'm not going to say they're going to necessarily slaughter the animals there, but they certainly make, you know, this is Germany, make sausages there and stuff. So we need those people. You know, I don't know why I have to travel across town to get a bloody sausage. This is not my first language. So, you know, bring them back and find a place where they can have a 20-year contract, because, you know, once you've moved to has anybody ever seen a print shop or a bookbinder shop? Those people don't move every 2 years. They don't just unplug their screen and go elsewhere. We're talking about tons of equipment. Same goes for a baker. So why not find a space for all these people where they can be in the middle of the city, have the shop downstairs, and the neighbors can buy stuff? I mean, it seems a very romantic idea, but that's how we lived 20 years ago. I grew up that way. I bought everything in my block.
And we're in a very short amount of time going to say goodbye to our live listeners, but we will continue. So as the show fades out, I'd remind you all to stay seated, those of you that are with us in the audience, and also contribute questions to the Q&A, which will be coming up shortly afterwards. Peter, I wanted to ask you, there's much talk about the built environment and all the positive ways that our cities are going to change. I think of driverless cars and controlling your appliances, should we ever need to, from outside of the house. But then I see people buying clawfooted baths from reclamation yards and living in Victorian semis. How are we navigating the push for novelty that design always creates and that market with sensible decisions about how to run our cities and how to build buildings within them?
Well, I think I don't really agree with Eric that everything has to be handmade, crafted and fixed, because actually we do have a lot of people living very positive lives who are able to move around, and they have a flexibility that you see now in workplaces that have grown hugely. You know, social work spaces have changed absolutely just in the last 5 years. Real changes in the way people operate, and it is much more flexible. And we do bake bread in London as well, Eric, actually. Now, there are lots of craft bakers.
Sausages aren't as good, though.
And I that's true.
They can't afford the same rent that a bank can afford.
They can't afford the same rent, but there are places where you find, with areas like Hackney, these places still exist and they are protected by the local council to make sure they stay there. And it's a very active environment where lots of craft people, from baristas to bike makers to all sorts of craft makers there. And that is something which I always wonder, is that a response to the fact that work is becoming more and more scarce as robots take over everything? And are we all going to be returning to traditional crafts in order to find just something to do rather than just look at screens all day long? So maybe society is preparing itself for a time without work. But in terms of what is happening to the city, is the sorts of changes that Eric says ought to take place, they are taking place at a snail's pace at the moment. You know, we have known since the 60s that the city of the car is finished, but still people love it. It is supported by the car industry. There are huge adverts everywhere telling you how wonderful it is to sit in your car and go much faster than the speed limit actually permits. And you know, in central London, now we have the problem of huge congestion because everybody who orders a book on Amazon and sends it to their office is causing congestion. That everyone who uses Uber means there are some 25,000 cars sitting around in a city holding up all the other traffic. You know, these things are actually complex issues that we have to deal with. And, you know, nobody is really taking the decision. Keep cars out of cities. You know, walking, cycling and public transport, active travel is the key way to do it. And London-wide, what we need is pay as you go for driving. So if you drive in the suburbs, okay, it's pretty cheap. If you come into the centre of town, it costs you an absolute fortune.
So the designers and urbanists among us are feeling like they've got a good showing, but I think the product designers have been given pretty short shrift so far. So, Joanna, I want to bring you in here and ask you, from your days as the editrix of Disenio, female editor. as your days looking after that, managing its coverage, what are the things that you're most excited about, the innovations which you can see actually making a difference in our everyday lives? Should we all be talking about 3D printing, or is it, as the two gentlemen here have mentioned, about re-engaging with the idea of craft and knowing how to physically make things with our hands?
I think re-engaging with the idea of craft is, in some cases, a very interesting concept, but I think that it tends to get quite fetishized and not necessarily so useful for our daily lives. A good example that has been running for the last few years are called Fixbirds. It's a website where you connect designers with people who actually need a service. And it can be anything from an old woman not being able to reach the top shelf in her kitchen, and she doesn't happen to have a young son or daughter close by and therefore needs some handy input from a designer to come and help her. And doesn't always need to be a designer, it could be anyone with some kind of skill. And that website connects people with makers and with people that need their help. And that I think is a really excellent kind of idea of where design really can enrich our lives and where design thinking can enrich our lives. And it's not necessarily about the kind of shiny, finished, beautiful product. Of course, those things also mean a lot to people, to be surrounded by things that we appreciate and things that we find beautiful are also important. But I think that we move further and further away from that within the design profession, to be honest. And I think designers will be called on for skills in other areas. And I think that skills to do with problem solving, skills to do with what you were talking about in terms of how you solve things like congestion in the cities, it's not just down to town planners and the city councils. I think that designers can actually have a really active part in that. And their skill set and their problem solving set is something that's really, really helpful in tackling those issues that we now face day to day.
And it's on that challenging note that we end the live part of this broadcast. Thank you very much to everyone listening all around the world, our editor Alex Funnell, back there with the shaggy hair, and the show's producer Henry Rees Sheridan. We'll be letting those listeners leave, and we'll be opening up the floor to our live listeners to ask a few questions via Q&A.